Blog Talk Radio.
Denise Griffiths is your partner in success. Tune in each Friday as virtual assistants, industry expert, web developer, and online entrepreneur Denise Griffiths interviews industry experts from one end of the internet to the other. These expert entrepreneurs freely share their business building knowledge and provide practical guidance that will show you how to build and grow your own very successful business, be it online or traditional brick and mortar. Now, ladies and gentlemen, your partner in success, Denise Griffiths.
Everybody, this is Denise Griffiths, and I welcome you to your Partner in Success Radio. This week, I'm really excited. I get to welcome to the show my friend, the legendary Jim Tunney. Jim is known as the Dean of NFL referees, and his 31-year NFL career has earned him a nomination for the Pro Football Hall of Fame 2012 class. As a National Football League referee for over a 30-year period, his approach to making their crew, T-E-A-M, team, the best it could be was by building chemistry among the crew. He was also privileged to be on the field to observe the team-building philosophies of legendary NFL coaches Don Shula, John Madden, Vince Lombardi, George, I think this is Hollis, is that right?
George Hollis. Sure.
George Hollis, Chuck Knoll, as well as many others. And Jim was on the field for three NFL Super Bowls, two of them back-to-back. One of the best things that I enjoy about Jim, we chat a lot, is that he is involved in leadership all of his life, and he has a core belief that leadership is more about responsibility than ability. Honesty, creating a positive climate, and trusting people are the important character traits of a true leader. All too often, and unfortunately, people with those strengths lack the courage or the initiative to step up. In this time of economic stress, these are important traits to have. So Jim's career has not only, during his career, he has not only played the role of an NFL referee, but at heart he is an educator, a success trainer, and now a very well-known speaker and author. Jim, I'm so excited to have you here. Welcome to your Partner in Success Radio.
Denise, that was very nice. I wonder if you do eulogies. I may need you someday.
No, because it's not going to happen.
Not soon, but someday.
No. I'm so excited to chat with you. We've been talking back and forth for quite a while about different things, and I just love your whole philosophy in life. But before we get too far afield, can you tell people a little bit about yourself? You just kind of give a quick bio, and we can go into that later, and tell people where they can find you on the web.
Well, I'll start with that. It's jimtunney.com, www.jimtunney.com. I write a weekly column called On the Tunney Side of Sports, and that's also on a website, www.tunneysideofsports.com. And I've been writing that for about 7 years now. But you mentioned something earlier about being always involved in leadership, and I hadn't thought about it until you said it, but I guess it did happen that way when I was a kid on the playground. My father was a recreation director in another city, but I always had a ball and a bat or some kind of equipment, so I always got to play because I bought the ball, mm-hmm. and you can't leave me out, even though I wasn't very good. And I thought, you know, I sort of started organizing kids playing. We played basketball together or softball together. And in the fourth grade, I was the captain of our softball team. In the fourth grade, I don't even remember how that happened, but it just seemed to be that's what I was supposed to do.
It seemed to be a natural thing.
It seemed to be natural. My dad was a teacher and a coach for a long time, and while I went to games when he was coaching, I was just like 5 and 6 years of age. I never thought about doing coaching or teaching or any of that at the time. I wanted to be a superstar. I wanted to catch the winning pass or a touchdown to win the game. But it just sort of evolved into, in a sense, following in his footsteps that I never thought I was doing, but if I look back on it, that's exactly what I did. Good mentor, good leader, good role model for me with my father.
Sounds like it. Well, you have a very interesting career history. I know you were a high school teacher, and then you became a superintendent. You were also a coach. didn't you do pretty much all of this kind of simultaneously?
When
it
I think about
like
it, I thought about the other day adding it all up. I must be about 110 years of age when you put them all together. When I was 12, I knew this, and I can cite that exactly. When I was 12, I knew what I wanted to do. Now, you guys, kids today, with their 12, they don't know what they're going to do when they're 13, but I wanted to be a coach. Again, my father was a coach, but I wanted to be a coach. That's what I wanted to do. So I went through high school and college, 8 years, looking at teachers and coaches, watching them, observing. Nobody told me to do this. I just said, well, if I'm going to do this, I want to do this the best I can. So what did the teacher do right? What did the coach do wrong? What things did they do I don't like? What did they things they do like? And I sort of mentally, to write it down, just mentally developed a checklist of the things that I wanted to do when I became a coach. And that's what I did. I graduated from college, and I went right into teaching and coaching. I was very fortunate to, when I did my student teaching, I was offered a position to coach and teach at a school, and I did that. And then some principal I had said, you know, you have more skills in teaching and coaching. Why don't we move you up into administration? So I went to become an assistant principal. We call it, in those days, we call it vice principal in the school I was in. And mm-hmm. It's true because I was in charge of the vice. I will tell you that. But they then became a high school principal. I thought it was a great job. And then I moved on to being a school superintendent. And all this time I was doing speaking because I was started in the NFL while I was doing this. And so people want to hear stories about the NFL. I remember the first speech I gave it years and years ago was at a Rotary Club. Somebody said, why don't you come and talk to a Rotary Club? I said, I don't know what to talk about. They would just tell us some, they call it jockstrap stories, you know, what goes on in the field, what do they talk about in the huddle, and things like that. I did that, and I see that it piqued the interest of people. And so I moved on from that sort of jockstrap stories to stories about how you make your life better.
Mm-hmm. But, Jim, how did you become an NFL? How did you even get involved in that if you're high school teacher? That's a big leap. I mean, I'm trying to figure out how you went from high school teacher to NFL.
Well, I was at Occidental College as a student, and I was a physical education major, and I wanted to be a coach, and I was playing summer league basketball, and they could do that in those days. And the playground director said, why don't you come earlier than the game that you play in and referee the little kids? And I said, well, okay, but you can't pay me because I'm an amateur. He said, no, we'll make you a playground director and pay you 90 cents an hour.
How much?
They did, 90 cents an hour, so I was refereeing them, and I kind of liked that. And then when I graduated from college, I began working high school games on the weekend. We were getting paid $12.50 at the time for a high school game, and I'd work two or three games a weekend, and I thought, gee, $25, $30 a weekend, that's like finding money. I love this. And that's just, I just went from there to high school, to small college, to major college, and up in the NFL. Just like a player does.
I'll be darned. Yeah, but how did you get to the NFL? That's what I'm dying to know. Did they find you? Did you find them?
That's a good question. Great insight that way.
How did it happen?
I didn't apply. Normally what happens today and has happened for years and has happened even when I was there, people applied to get into the NFL. I was working in what they now is called the Pac-10. It was in those days called Pacific Coast Conference. It was here on the West Coast with USC and UCLA and Stanford and Cal and things like that. And I was working those games as a referee, and I was on national television a couple of times. And when the season was over in 1959, the supervisor of the AFL, that's the American Football League, which was just starting in 1960, had no officials, called me and said, we'd like you to work in the AFL. We'll pay you such and such, which is much better than you in college. I said, great. Well, before I could sign that contract, the NFL called. They were buying in those days. The NFL called and said, don't sign anything with the AFL. We want you to work in the NFL. So I took the NFL, and I was fortunate enough that they found me. I didn't find them, and I never even applied. And they're probably about, 1,000, maybe 2,000 people that apply to the NFL today, and they select 4 or 5. So I was, in those days, I was fortunate to be at the right place at the right time.
Right, serendipity, absolutely. Plus, you had been working all of, you know, you'd been doing all this time. So, I mean, clearly you were the right person for the job at the right time.
Well, I guess so, but and it worked out very well for me. I chose the NFL over the AFL, as I mentioned, because I was starting as a field judge. That's a downfield position in the league, and I could work with the referee who is the crew chief, and I worked with probably a dozen of them that were really great mentors. And the first book I wrote called Impartial Judgment, I wrote a chapter in there called We All Need Mentors, and I Had the Best. And my father was the first, and other referees that I worked with, Bob Brubaker, and people who have long gone since, but they were great mentors to me, and I learned from them. And then later on, I get to be the position of referee, for 25 years, in the position of referee. That's the crew chief. And that was a great opportunity for me to continue my teaching and coaching skills.
Wow. You know, I don't even know where to start. I have so many questions. So I'm going to pepper you. Just be prepared.
Ready.
So you were, okay, good. So you were doing, you were high school. So you were working in high school. You were a superintendent. You were NFL. You had a family.
Yes.
How do you breathe? I mean, when did you find time to breathe? Or was it just, this is my real question, Jim. Did you just love everything that you did so much that it was just effortless? Because I find in my life that when I am in what I call flow and I am loving everything that I do, it's not work. I'm not, you know, I'm not struggling. I can crank out an enormous body of work, and I'm having a real good time doing it. And it sounds like that's what you were doing as well.
Great description. Exactly. I would get up in the morning at 5:30 and go run, and then I would jump in my car and drive 45 minutes to the school where I was a principal across town in downtown inner city Los Angeles, and I'd be there till maybe 6:00, 6:30 at night, and drive home and take a briefcase home and have dinner with the family and do my homework like my kids were doing their homework, and then I'd do the same thing over and over, and then Friday night we'd have a dance or a football game at the school, and Saturday morning I'd get on an airplane and fly from Los Angeles to Detroit or Miami or Boston or someplace and referee a football game. Sunday night, because I lived on the West Coast, I'd fly back home, get home back in the airport about 9, home around 10. There was no security system in those days. It was a little easier to travel. And get up the next morning at 5:30 and go run again. And did that during the football season 7 days a week. And I always thought that it was important for me, particularly as a high school principal in downtown inner city Los Angeles, to be in the school building on Monday morning when the teachers got there. So I was always there by 7:15. And the reason for it was that I didn't want them to think that, oh, now I'm on national television with the NFL, and I'm a big shot, and I'm all that sort of thing. I wanted them to know that I cared about them, and I talked to people, particularly in customer service. I call it customer care. And I say, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. Well, how do you show care? Well, you show it by your being with them and attitude toward them, not just the fact that, I mean, you ask anybody, do you care about your family, do you care about your other people? He says, yeah, well, okay, how do you show that? And I felt I needed to demonstrate that. That's one of the reasons that I say that leadership is not so much about ability as it is responsibility, and you need to step up and do that. And you're right, Denise, I just flowed. It was, for me, it was one thing I'm saying, oh, tired? Oh, sure. You know, football season down in November gets a little, you've been doing it since August, and it gets a little tiresome, but it's a renewal for me. And every time I, at school, was, you know, we had 2,000 kids in school, 2,200 actually, and 125 teachers and about 10,000 parents have seen me. So it was just something to do all the time. I just love doing it.
Right. And here's the thing. I mean, once you start doing something that you're very effective at doing, that you know you love, that you're actually helping other people, and they're helping you by responding to you, life gets a lot easier.
When you
struggle with everything, it does. But when you're struggling or you're worried about money and you're worried about this, you're not really concentrating on what, as you say, customer care is
exactly.
Really one of the most important things. And customer care in my book is, I mean, it's everywhere. It's your family, it's your cat, it's your dog. You know, you have to be in the moment. You have to take care of your relationships with everything and everybody. And customer care is just a real good umbrella for that.
And I guess I learned from my dad, particularly my mom as well. My mom was two terrific parents. And I learned I want to get better at what I do. Maybe that's an insecurity in me, but I want to get better at what I do. So while I was being a high school principal, I did start working on my doctorate. So I would go to school at night, and I would leave school at maybe 4 o'clock to go to a 4:15 class at the University of Southern California and got my degree and master's, and my doctorate work took 4 years. And I thought that would be a real advantage for me in terms of being able to get from one position to the other. And it had been. I think I was selected as an assistant superintendent and then superintendent largely because I had done this study on education and curriculum and things like that, so that I had a different expertise than just being on the job. And that mm-hmm. always has been good for me. In fact, if we go back to the NFL, Denise, and think about somebody said the other day, they counted up, I worked over 500 NFL games, and whenever I worked a game, as I walked off the field, I would think, did I leave this game better than I found it? How could I do this job better? And that's always been a goal for me, not only just being driven, but an incentive to see how I could do the job better.
Mm-hmm. One of my clients, and you and I have talked about him, I won't mention him here, his thing, and he says this every day, he writes it in his emails, it's kind of his mantra, if you will, and it's more in the form of a question, and that question is every day. He asks himself, and I do too as a result of my affiliation with him, if you will, because I learn from everybody that I come across. And the question that he asks himself every day is, how can I be 1% better today than I was yesterday?
Mm.
And that's a pretty powerful question to ask yourself.
It's a powerful question. It's a good number, too. Rather than saying, how can I be 10% or 100% better, just 1% better. And maybe he uses, because I use the example that at 211 degrees, water is hot, but it doesn't boil until it gets to 212.
Mm.
It's just 1 degree different.
And
if you play a little golf from time to time and look at the pro golfers down there, and I wouldn't want to be a pro golfer. It's a tough, tough business. And the difference between them is maybe 1.7 strokes difference between the top guy and the bottom guy. And the guy who finishes first versus the guy who finishes second. The guy who finishes first wins $1 million. The guy who finishes second earns $500,000. And in one stroke, and he's lost a difference of $500,000. So that 1 degree of difference is what it's all about. And that's how people are selected. Are you 1 degree better than the next person I can choose from?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I watch the Winter Olympics every year. I don't watch a whole lot of sports, but I love the Winter Olympics. And let me tell you, when these guys lose, the difference between gold, silver, and bronze is a millionth of a second. I just
died.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's just not right. But apparently it's okay with them. But, oh, my gosh, that's painful to watch sometimes.
It is, because you always want the gold. You always want to be at the best. And, when you don't, you're disappointed in it. But I always say it's not a failure. It's just a setback. And you mm-hmm. step up and you try it again. You just do better that 1 degree difference the next time.
I absolutely agree. And that's what American exceptionalism, American entrepreneurism is all about. You just get out of bed and you do what you need to do every day, and you do it a little bit better the next day.
And that's what I try to share with audiences, my experiences in education as a teacher and a coach, and combine that with what's going on with the football field. And you mentioned in the introduction people like Don Shula or John Madden or George Halas or Vince Lombardi, great leaders of teams that got their teams to the Super Bowl. Halas never got the Super Bowl, but he was kind of the founder of the NFL. And I watched their leadership styles. They're much different than what they do. Tom Landry was much different in Dallas than Chuck Noll was in Pittsburgh. But they're different styles of leadership, and I studied that, thinking, what can I take from that that I can use? I don't want to duplicate that. I don't want to emulate that, but I want to find ideas that they are using that will work for me. And copying them isn't the answer. I could never be a Don Chula or a Vince Lombardi, but I could be a better Jim Tunney by saying, okay, I can use this and do that, and I can do this a little bit better. And so I studied leadership, and I've always thought about people who talk about leadership but have never been a leader. And fortunately, I've had the opportunity to become not only a referee in the football field in front of 70,000 people in the stadium and 77 million watching on television, running a football game. In fact, I thought one time, just digressing, I was in the middle of a game one time, I was thinking, my goodness, am I good enough to be running this football game? I'm in charge of this thing. I mean, there's nobody else here but me that I've got other officials doing duties, but I was the crew chief. I was the boss. I was the guy in charge. Could I really do this? Am I that good? I think, no, you're not that good, but you're in charge, so you better do a good job. And this little kid from San Gabriel, California, who played on the playground, is now running a National Football League Super Bowl, for example. And so I was there, been there, done that. And being a high school principal in inner city schools for 10 years, a school superintendent, it's been a great opportunity for me to pull those two entities together, to be on the platform in front of people talking about not only how they can get better, but enjoying it. And I always thought the way to help people learn, and I did this in the classroom as a teacher, and I did this as a principal, is to attack them viscerally, get them laughing, enjoying, and having fun. And learning isn't hard. And you said earlier about once you're into the flow of it, it isn't really work anymore. You really enjoy it.
No, it's not.
And once you're into
it's so much fun.
Yeah, and the same thing with learning. Is once you're into learning, it isn't that hard if you're learning how and being taught how to enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. And you know, everybody has a different means of learning. Some people learn by watching, you know, videos. I mean, videos are huge right now. I'd rather get hit in the head by a brick than sit and watch a bunch of videos. But I'm not visually stimulated.
Well, you don't need to be hit by a
brick.
But, you know, we do learn either auditorily or visually or kinetically. And
right.
I've said to people many times, particularly to parents and teachers, you know, if you ever say, if I've told you once, I've told you 1,000 times. Well, if you're having to tell your kid or a student 1,000 times, that's not the way the student is learning. They're learning
working
in a different way. You change your style. You've got to fit the student's style. The student is going to change. Well, they told me this before. I guess I better. It's got to fit the student or the learner's system of learning.
Well, and I guess once we figure out how we learn best, I learn by reading. I also learn by breaking something and then fixing it.
Mm.
You know, I'm known for that. You know, I'll get in and into a system, and, well, I'm known for that for me because I know that I'm going to do it, and I'll just blunder in it. I don't like to read the instructions.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to watch the videos, even though I know I can learn something. They just annoy me. And I get in and I break it, and I instantly learn what not to do, which is how I learn.
Go.
You know, kind of like, you know, don't touch that burner because you're going to get burnt. Well, I get burnt all the time. But I don't do it again.
But you don't do it again, exactly.
No,
I think
you know.
We said this about athletics. You learn a lot more when you lose the game than when you win the game.
Right.
When you win the game,
well,
you don't study the film or the system or why you won as diligently as when you lose. You study it more and more and in more detail as how you fix it, exactly that way.
Well, and it may be, and maybe you can answer this for me, I think I'm setting up competition within my own self. It's like, okay, let's break this and see how long it takes to fix it. And then, okay, well, you learned that, you're not going to do that one again. All right, now go break something else. It's sometimes I think it's a game that I set up with myself just to, you know, prevent myself from being bored.
I hope you set up games, and I do, to just numbers. When somebody I could maybe hear it on the radio or hear somebody talking about certain numbers. I add them together in my head as quick as I can, only because I'm testing myself. And I can think even as a kid, when I walked down the street, from time to time, I'd walk just along the curb just to check my balance. I wouldn't step on a line, or I'd step four times and then not on the fifth one. You know, that sort of thing. Just little games like that. It keeps testing you. Sure. And I think
it challenges you. Right?
Yeah, and that's exactly what it's all about. Challenge yourself to do a little better by any little game that you play. I still do that. I do that all the time in a different way. Back when I walked on the football field, when I walked the football field before the game, I would never step on the white line. I would always step over.
Oh,
now, once
really?
The game started, you can't do that because you're focusing on other things. But
right.
when you're just walking on the field, I would never step on the goal line or the sideline or the white chalk. I would step over that and step
now
over that.
I have to know the story. Do you know why you started doing that or when you started doing that?
Yeah, I know when I started doing it. I was a kid. I was 5, 6, 7 years of age. I would do little things like that. Nobody taught me. Nobody said anything. It just seemed to me that was something I wanted to do. And
right.
I don't think you can take your 5 and 6 year old and say, look, why don't you try stepping on over these? Maybe I saw somebody do it. I don't remember that. I said, oh, that's a good thing to learn. I just did it, and nobody taught me. When I walked to the football field, not to step on the line, I just did it. I thought, you know.
Wow.
Maybe it was a sense that line has just been rechalked and I didn't want to mess it up or something, but I stepped over the line. Sure. It's just those little things I do constantly in my life, even today as I get a little older and older, I'm still doing things, and doing things in terms of testing my mind and my memory and my ability to do things that I maybe didn't do before, because that's the way I keep active. That's the way I keep my brain active, and that's one of the things about writing the Tiny Sidus Force. I write this weekly column of 400 words every single week, and I send it to the newspaper on Friday, so it's published on Monday, and I send it out on Constant Contact to several thousand people, and it's a great challenge for me. If I digress for that for a second, let me just say I take issues from the world of sports and translate them into positive examples for everyday living.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read your column, I know.
There's always something in the world of sports, good, bad, right, or wrong. Take a bad thing that people take a Michael Vick and the dog fighting they did a few years ago. That can be a positive lesson for people, because the lesson was, don't hang around with those kind of people.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Vick hung around with the wrong kind of guys, and the wrong kind of guys got him into all that, and he had all this money, and it almost destroyed his life. He was in prison for a number of years, and you take examples like that and helping people doing a better job. That's a great challenge for me to try to find examples. Mm-hmm. And you'd look at a game or you'd look at a sporting event, and I'd look at the same one and I'd see something in there that you didn't, just because of my background experience.
Right.
Sure.
Right.
And you'd see something that I didn't, perhaps. Yeah.
Right. Well, I would be looking at it from a totally often appalled point of view, I have to be honest. I look at some of these kids get involved and I say, oh my gosh, really? But, you know, it does become a learning opportunity, one would hope. So,
well, as I mentioned earlier, we all need mentors. And I think one of the things that hurts society today is that there's so many homes that are broken up that people don't have good parental role models. And if they don't, then they need to find somebody else. But they need to find it. You can't take some kid out of the ghetto and say, gee, you have this background. Why don't you find a role model? No, you've got to do that. That's why we use the word step up. You've got to step up and make that happen. And when you look for something like that to make your life better, if that's what you want to do, if you don't want to do that, that's your choice too. But if you want to do something with your life, then look for somebody who's doing something better or different than you did. And again, when I was go back to the playground, I guess I learned a lot from the playground, but When I was 8 or 9, I would play on this little pickup basketball game with kids that are 10 and 12. And when I was 12, I'd play with kids that are 14 and 15. And when I got to be a high school principal, I would hang around with guys who have been a high school principal 10 and 12 years, and I was in my first or second year, only because they already learned the things that I needed to learn, and I wanted to accelerate that learning curve. And I hung around with people who did that better than I did, and I was just the youngest guy in the group. Now we're gone, the oldest guy in the group. So I share those ideas that I learned with other people.
Right. Did you do this consciously, or did you just recognize it as time went on?
It just sort of seemed like that's what I was supposed to do. I mean, nobody told me to do that. Nobody, my dad or someone else, didn't say, well, listen, hang around with this guy, because I did have some people I recognized were doing a good job, and I just said, if I have an issue on something, could I call you about that? Oh, yeah, please do. And so I would call them and ask them, or I would be with them. In the meetings, I wouldn't sit with guys my age. I would sit with the guys who were older than I was. And the same thing happened in the NFL. I started in the NFL. I signed a contract when I was 30 years of age. Well, that doesn't happen anymore. NFL guys don't get started until in their late 30s or early 40s. And I was young, and I hung around guys who have been in the league for a long time, and I learned a lot from them. That's why I mentioned in the NFL, I was a young field judge, downfield position, as I mentioned, and I hung around with guys and worked with guys that had been in the league for 10 and 12 and 15 years. Man, you learn a lot that way. So it was a great, great benefit to me to do that. I think, to answer your question, I learned that from the playground. I mean, that's how it was for me.
And see, that's actually the way I've lived my life, and I guess that's why I'm so curious. I've always gravitated towards people that had more knowledge than I had.
Sure.
It's just the perfect, it just makes sense to me. I'm not going to hang around and never have had with people who just, they're not doing anything, or they're lazy, or they're not going anywhere. I just have, good for them, but I don't want to hang around with that.
Did somebody, when you were younger, a parent or somebody tell you to do that?
No, it was just always very natural for me.
It just was there. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. My grandmother, I remember my grandmother saying one time, grandmothers have these sayings that at the time you don't get them, you don't understand them at all, but years down the road you're like, aha,
that's exactly
what she meant. But she would say something along the lines, well, water seeks its own level.
Yeah.
And I always did. I just never wanted to hang around with people who did not really stimulate me intellectually.
Yep.
I just had no intentions of doing that.
And that's exactly the kind of thing that you mentioned, the aha, that excites me about the opportunity to speak. I've been speaking now for several decades, and what's exciting about it, and being in front of whether it's 15 people in Chicago I spoke to not long ago, or 1,400 people I spoke to in Texas recently, I want to see their eyes light up. I want to see something happen. I want to see that aha when you say something. That's good. Whether they write it down or whether they, now as you're speaking, the groups are doing, they're sitting there listening to you with their laptops in front of them. And making notes. And I'm thinking, whoa. Now, maybe they're making notes, or maybe they're sending emails to their buddies, but they're still working on their laptops. But hopefully that they'll light up when you say something. That's the exciting part for a speaker, is to see that you've made a difference. And again, as I mentioned, walking off the field, when I leave a speech, I always think, could I have done better with this audience than I did? What could I do better? So I always call a meeting planner back and say, what did you like? What can I do better? Don't just tell me I did a good performance. Say thank you very much, but what could I have done better? And occasionally somebody will say, well, if you put this, we want to hear more about this or hear more about that. And that helps me. It helps me grow.
Sure. It's constructive criticism. Now, I do have to say, I heard from a mutual friend of ours that you were at, I believe it was an NSA meeting recently. Weren't you speaking in front of a bunch of other speakers?
Yes.
And you got several standing ovations, I heard.
Well, that happens. Standing ovations are nice.
I'm going to put you on the spot here.
But I'm critical of my own performance more than anybody else's. I just want to do a better job, and if
right.
they get standing ovations, why, that's nice. Well, it's always gratifying that.
Yeah, but look who you were speaking to. That was pretty impressed. She was impressed, I'll tell you.
Well, that feeds your ego, but but it's nice, and it's a nice reward for that, and it's always good to have an audience appreciate and value. But more so, I want to see what they do with it. What do they do the next day, or the next week, or the next month that maybe not just change their life? I'm not sure the speaker says, I will change your life with this speech. I'm not sure you change them. But you can make adjustments and you make fine tunings. Just kind of, as you said earlier, that 1%, just a little bit 1% different each day.
Yeah.
And you're doing fine. So, well, thank you.
And here's what I find too, Jim. I will hear something that I'll go, that's pretty interesting. But it has to percolate.
Mm.
And it may be 6 months later, it might be a year later, I have that moment like, oh, I got it now. You hear it when you need to hear it. You know, you heard it the first time, but when it's time for you to really understand it, then it comes back to you.
And I try to get the message across to teachers. You know, I've yet to, maybe it happened, but I don't think I've ever been present when at the end of the class, the teacher got a standing ovation for a chemistry class or an English class or a math class or a history class.
Right.
And yet they're doing a wonderful job with kids, but you give that kid 5 years and he comes back 5 years later and goes to Mrs. Green and says, Mrs. Green, I want to tell you, when I was in your class, it was the best, it was wonderful for me. Well, Mrs. Green wants to say, well, listen, dummy, why don't you tell me that when you were in my class? Well, it percolated. It took a while.
When you're ready, it's there.
Yeah.
That's the thing about knowledge. You don't use knowledge that you learn that day half the time. It has to work its way through the labyrinth in your head.
Sure. There's an old, kind of was Confucius, not my old saying, that says, when the teacher is ready, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear.
Teacher will appear.
The student is
absolutely
ready, the teacher will appear. Mm-hmm. And it was nice just a couple of months ago, I was inducted into the high school, Fairfax High School Hall of Fame. I was principal at Fairfax High School in Los Angeles for 7 years, and I was inducted into their Alumni Hall of Fame. Well, I'm not an alumnus. I'm the first faculty member in the history of the school to be inducted into the Alumni Hall of Fame. And I said, why? And they said, well, because you made an impression on us when you were here. And I said, but that was years ago. Why didn't you tell me that? it was a wonderful honor to have students come back that I taught as principal of their school some 34 years ago, and 30 or 40 years ago, and they come back and they say, well, this is what we learned from you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what it's all about. So I say to the teacher, don't be upset if you don't get that standing ovation at the end of the class, but know that you're making a difference in the lives of young people, and the same thing as the speaker. I hope I make a difference in the lives of the people in the audience that I speak to.
Yeah, I know you do. Well, let's go back to the NFL, because I'm getting people sending me emails like, I have NFL questions. What are some of your most memorable games?
Of the 500, as I mentioned, probably the three Super Bowls that I was a referee. And if I had to identify one, just to answer the question, I'd say it was probably Super Bowl 11, which was played January 9th, 1977. I remember the date very well, in the Rose Bowl in Pasadena. Memorable for me because I grew up just 4 miles from that Rose Bowl. I went there as a little kid. Again, my dad was a referee, so I was there. I sat on the bench alongside of a famous athlete named Jackie Robinson, the one who broke the color barrier in the Major League Baseball. I said, Jackie Robinson changed the lives of a lot of people when he played as a Negro, as they call him those days, a black in the NFL, in the Major League Baseball. And then I refereed games when I was starting out, high school games and the Rose Bowl and junior college games and so on. And then to be assigned to referee to the first time they've ever played the Super Bowl in my Rose Bowl. It was my home. I knew the stadium very well, and it was just everything brought home to me. All of my history of playing and coaching and teaching and refereeing all came home to me in that Super Bowl 11. That was Oakland Raiders, Minnesota Vikings, and it was a great experience for me.
Jim, was your dad alive then? Was he able to attend any of these with you?
No, he wasn't. My dad passed away in 1965. In fact, I should make an edit to that. In 1947, that goes quite a way back, my dad refereed the Rose Bowl game between UCLA and Illinois. That was a college game. I was there when he refereed that game. And then 30 years later, to the month of January of 1977, from 47 to 77, I get a chance to work in the same place that my dad worked. And my dad had been dead at that point for about 12 years, but he was there. He was in there. I didn't see him there, but I'm sure he was sitting in the stands watching. You know. So it was one of those games that just my mom was there, my family was there, my kids were there. It was. I think I bought 100 tickets for that game just so I get it was in my backyard, so I get all my family in there. It was a great experience for me.
Nice. That is a lovely story. Is that in any of your books? I mean,
I wrote that in a book called Impartial Judgment. Yes, years ago. In fact, that Impartial Judgment is sort of a chronology of my 31 years in the NFL, as long as a lot of other experiences that I've had. But I wanted to title the book because I don't care who wins. Because as a referee, I don't care who wins. I want the game to be played fairly and by the rules. And the editor thought, nah, that didn't sound like a good title, so we changed the title to Impartial Judgment, which is true. I have an impartial judgment of the game. I just work the game when I don't care who wins, type of thing. So, but I recall that story many times to people because it does, I mean, I can think of the game. And in fact, it's ironic that this is November the 4th, as we talk, a week from today is 11-11-11.
Right.
And I worked Super Bowl 11.
Oh, you did. That's
so,
right.
And I'm emceeing an event on that night, the 11-11-11, of a lot of NFL legends that are coming to town for a golf tournament. And I'll be emceeing that. We're honoring a fellow named Ted Hendricks who played in Super Bowl 11. So it's like the full circle has come around. It just keeps going around and around. So but NFL, to work in the NFL for 31 years was 3 Super Bowls and 25 Monday night games, when Monday Night Football was the game of the week. Everybody would stop everything. So another book I wrote called Super Bowl Sunday, The Day America Stops, I wrote about Super Bowl 11 in that book, too. So it's in a couple of books I've written, yeah.
Yeah. Do you mind sharing some of the people that you're going to be seeing? Are there some names that we should be paying attention to?
Well, there's some people like Nick Bonacani, who played for the Super Bowl Miami Dolphins. There are a lot of Oakland Raiders. Jack Youngblood, who is in the Hall of Fame. Tom Mack, who's in the Hall of Fame. Just probably be 25, 30 celebrity captains, as we call them. And there's a guy named Eddie LeBaron that nobody remembers, but Eddie LeBaron was 5'9". He was a quarterback in the NFL in the early days. And he could hardly see over the lineman, and today he couldn't see over them all. But he's quite a wonderful man and a great football player, but a wonderful person. These are just wonderful guys, and it's ironic that a referee who's sort of in an adversarial position with players and coaches during the game. I mean, you're not on their Christmas card list.
I wouldn't think so.
But
that was going to be my
we've
next
become
question.
Good friends.
How many?
In fact, many of them have written letters supporting that nomination to the Hall of Fame, saying, you know, there's never been an NFL game official selected in the Hall of Fame. They've just avoided it all these years. So, being nominated, my goal is to open the door to say, you know, you can't play a football game without officials, without referees. You can't
right.
do that. So why shouldn't they be contributors to the game? And nobody's taken the initiative to try to open that door. Well, I'll be the scapegoat. I'll see if I can do that, and we'll see what happens. So but it's wonderful being associated with so many of these coaches and players, and it became you feel like you're the brethren, you know. So
yeah. Well, when does the voting take place on that, Jim?
I'm sorry?
For the NFL Hall of Fame, when does that... That comes up in January, doesn't it?
What they do is they nominate you now, and it will actually on the month of September and October, and then they will move up. There's a number of people nominated, but they'll move 15 of those forward to January, and then the day before the Super Bowl, they will sit down, the committee of the sports writers sit down and judge who they should have in it. And they'll have, it's mostly for players, and there are some coaches that are in it, and there are some other people, but like a Pete Rozelle, who is a commissioner, but there's never been an official. And and so maybe it'll happen, and I hope that it does, so that we can help the people understand. And people I talk to, what do you mean there's officials in Major League Baseball? Yes. NBA basketball, yes. NHL hockey, yes. Boxing, yes. But not football. Why not?
Well, not football.
The committee hasn't seen fit to do that yet. Maybe we can convince them that they need to do that. We'll see. We'll see what happens.
Seems like it's time for a change.
It's a nice honor to be nominated.
Yeah, I'm really excited for you, and I can't wait to see how this shakes out. So, Jim, what I really want to talk with you right now is, I mean, you have this wonderful career. It spanned a lot of different things. They're all interconnected. I mean, I can see that very clearly. Right now, your career is as a speaker. What is it that excites you the most about being a speaker? And I mean, I don't even know. If you try to put me on a stage, I would bolt. So it's not something that I would. All you would see was, you know, ankles and elbows. I'd be out the door. But I know for some people it's a lot of fun. And what do you enjoy most about being a speaker?
The real key for me, Denise, is the ability, the opportunity, the privilege, I should say, to prepare for the audience. Each speech that I give, while it's maybe some words that I've said before, some examples that I've used before, is to take those examples, to take my learning experiences that I've had from education or from the NFL or from just from life, and relate it to that particular audience. Now, the U.S. Wheat Association that I spoke for recently is much different than the Dell Case computer people that I spoke for not too long ago. So you have different audiences, but they're all interested in you doing better. So how do I take my experiences and relate to that? So in preparing for the speech, I not only have a pre-programmed questionnaire that I ask people to fill out, but I also make phone calls to people who are going to be there and say, I understand you're going to be attending such and such a meeting. I'm the keynote speaker. What is your goal in attending this meeting? When you walk out of that room after one or 2 days or whatever, or even after the presentation I make, what do you want to walk away from? What do you want to take with you that'll make you better either personally or professionally or both? And so I talk to those people and learn from that. And so tailor the things that I have, my experiences, my background, to that audience. Just to get up and just give the same old speech over and over and over, to me is boring. Not only to them, but to me. I like.
Well, and if your heart's not in it, they're going to get that, aren't they? I mean,
absolutely.
Your energy and your passion.
They have to have that fire in your belly. If you don't have that fire in your belly and have that energy that way, they're not going to be paying attention to you. So, again, humor is important, and I try to bring in stories that are humorous that will relate to them, not just stories that are funny for me, but will relate to them. And if I can relate to them and get them laughing and get them being with me and saying, gee, I'm going to like to listen to this guy, then I can take them any place. It's like a football coach that gets the attention of his players by knowing that the players know that that coach cares about them. As I mentioned before, the audience doesn't care how much you know until they know how much you really care about them. And if you care and show attitude for them and knowledge about what they do, well, this guy doesn't have a clue about what I do. He's talking about different things that may be important, but that's not what I do. Well, I'm going to learn what they do. That's the exciting part for me, is the learning, the preparation of getting the speech ready for that particular audience.
You know, I have to say, and this is an eye-opener for me, because I have a lot of clients who are speakers, and I work with a lot of speakers at different levels, maybe not as a client, but I may interview them. You know, I know a lot of speakers and authors.
Mm-hmm.
You're the first person, I have to say, who has ever said just exactly what you just said, that you actually call people, that you do the I mean, I know there are probably speakers who do it. I'm not aware of it. But that was an eye-opener for me. I mean, what a brilliant idea. Pick up the phone and ask them what they want.
The more you know about your audience, the better prepared you will be. And
absolutely.
And again, see the examples. For example, walking on the field right for a football game is the next important thing. The most important thing is, as I look at film before that game, studying plays, studying rules, and being knowledgeable of the rules, being so knowledgeable of the rules that nobody on that field knows the rules better than I do, and studying the game, knowing the systems, knowing what's happening before I work the game. And I think if you study that, and the officials do that, they call it film study. Some of them fall asleep during the film. But if you're paying attention and you want to do a better job, you learn from that so that when you walk on the field, you're ready. We always say expect the unexpected, and that comes in preparation. And a fellow told me a long time ago, he said, the will to prepare is more important than the will to win. And yet people think about the will to win. That's the important thing. No. The will to prepare makes it easier for the will to win, because you are ready to go. You are expecting the unexpected, and you can step into it in any situation that comes to you, whether you're on the football field, whether you're on the platform. Unusual situations. I can always recall I spoke to a group of Southern California electrical contractors at the Universal City in Los Angeles, in Hollywood, and the lights went out before the speech.
A little bit of irony there.
And I said, hey, this is what you guys are electrical contractors. We had candles on the tables. And I said, what's wrong, you guys? And you know what they said? That's not my job.
Oh, my God.
In other words, it was somebody else's job to fix that, but it wasn't their job. That's what you guys do. I thought that really comes around when you're working with electrical contractors and the lights go out. But I think that preparation is what it's all about.
Right.
That you learn as a teacher. You know, you see kids do your homework, but if you don't do your homework before you come into the classroom to teach, you're not ready to do it. You've got
That's
to do
exactly
your homework.
Right.
You've got to prepare. And your kids and now my grandkids, I don't like homework. Hey, I'm still doing homework. I've been doing homework all my life, and I think because homework is what makes your job easier. You'll have more fun in school if you'll do your homework the night before and walk in prepared. You'll be a better principal if you'll do your homework before the class, before school starts the next day. And unfortunately, I always work home to do, and I regret the time that I was away from my family for doing that, but it was something I had to do better.
And I'm sure that they completely understand that. And you said something a few minutes ago that really grabbed my attention about unusual circumstances. Jim, as far as I'm concerned, life is an unusual circumstance. Every minute of every day. I mean, my head's on a swivel all the time. I'm always looking for what's coming around the corner.
Sure.
I love it. Life to me is this grand adventure. And I love it. I do.
It's a great word, adventure.
Yeah, it is. It's a great adventure. But like you, I'm a chronic student. I am constantly learning something. Look, if I go to bed at night and I haven't learned something new that day, and I mean learn something that made me struggle a bit to learn it, I have to get up and go learn something. I can't sleep. My brain will not let me rest unless I have solved a problem that day.
And I think it concerns me about some of our younger people who spend a lot of time on their iPods, iPads, cell phones, you know, and maybe they're learning and they know more about that than I do, perhaps. But I see kids walking down the street with these headsets in their ears. I said, wait a minute, take those earphones off and just watch life.
If
life unfolds in front of you.
Right, right. I was talking with Larry Winget one day, and he said the same exact thing. You know, and it was kind of a long conversation, so I won't repeat it here. But a couple of days later, I walked down to the mailbox. I live in a very rural little neighborhood, and I like it. I can hear birds. I can hear church bells. It suits me just fine. And he was right. I mean, these four kids, I didn't even know there was four kids in the neighborhood. I mean, they just don't go out and play. But these four kids got off the bus. They were walking abreast in the road because it's a very quiet road. And they were not speaking to one another. They all had earphones on. They were all punching away at their little keyboards. They were not interacting with one another. One of them wouldn't even pick up his feet off the ground. I could hear him schlepping along the road. And, Jim, I stood there at my mailbox, and I watched him walk towards me. Do you know that they never acknowledged that I was even in the same world with him? They just kept on going.
I'm concerned about it.
It broke my heart. I was so sad. I wanted to say, y'all, raise your heads. Take a deep breath. There are birds out here. You see that squirrel right there? There's a car behind you. You're about to get creamed. I wanted to smack. I wanted to do the keyboard smack where you just go down the row and get them all at one time. I didn't know who to be upset with, them or their parents. It was very sad.
Yeah. And part of the parents, you know, have so many other things to do now, they don't pay attention to their kids. That was very fortunate with me that my parents did pay attention. And hopefully as a parent that I paid attention to my kids. I still do talk to them every day. So.
Well, Jim, I cannot believe this. We're running out of time. I love chatting with you. Is there anything, you've had this fabulous life, this fabulous career, what is your message to people? I mean, if you had to just kind of distill it down to one or two sentences, what would you tell people about life?
Well, first of all, thank you for the opportunity to share and talk with you. It's a pleasure visiting with you. But somebody asked me the other day, and you've done all these things, is your best life ahead of you or behind you?
It's ahead of you.
And I said ahead of me. That's right. And yet you've done all these things with another, and they rattle off all these things that you just did this last hour, and think, well, that's pretty good, but I think there's something better out there.
But that's in the rearview mirror. That's all done. It's part of who you are, absolutely, but you're not living in those moments now. You're living in this one.
I told the story, and perhaps you heard it, and I'll be quick about it. Is a lady was doing her last rites with a minister, and he said, anything else? She said, yes, I'd like you to put me in a casket with a fork in my hand. And he said, what? A fork in my hand. He said, why? He said, well, when I was growing up, at Sunday dinner, my mom would say, clearing the dish, she'd say, keep your fork. And I knew if I kept my fork, something good was going to come to me.
So I'm
always thinking about the fork. Something good is going to happen.
That's right.
That's absolutely right.
It is. And, you know, we all have regrets. We all have shoulda, coulda, woulda. But you can't live with those.
No.
It's just a huge mistake, especially in today's economy. I mean, get your butt up. Go do something that you like. Help other people. Pretty simple.
Absolutely. Just keep that. And the more you do for other people, the more things come back to you. No question about that. It's always when we finish our conversation, I have a phone call I want to make about a fellow who's having some difficulties in his life, and I'm going to give him a call and see what is going on. Say hello. I may not be able to help him, but just to say hello. That may be all the help I can give him. That always helps. That helps come back to me, too.
It does, absolutely. Jim, thank you so much for being with me here today. I love chatting with you. I think I've said that once or twice. But I absolutely have such a great time chatting with you, whether it's on the radio or on the phone or even through email. It has been a huge pleasure, and I know our audience is taking away some really valuable insight and information.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you, Jim.
Hope you do it again.
I'll call you after a bit, too. No, we will. I would love to have you come back.
Thank you,
everybody, for being here. And the show will be available for download in about an hour. And this is Denise Griffiths and Jim Tunney wishing you a great day and a wonderful weekend. Thank you, Jim.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.